Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene this meeting of the Education Finance Division. I want to thank everyone for their attendance at the joint hearing yesterday afternoon. It was a powerful afternoon of testimony on the challenges that too many of our students experience with mental health currently, and the challenges that our schools face in stepping up to helping students manage those challenges and take down those barriers to their development and achievement. So thank you all for attending that. I'd like to start today with approval of the January 17th minutes. Representative Bennett, have you had a moment with those?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the January 17th. No, what did you say?
Yes, 17th.
Whatever minutes. Yes, I move those.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the approval of the January 17th minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Richardson, have you had a chance to review the January 22nd minutes?
I am right now. Yes, I have.
All right. Representative Richardson moves approval of the January 22nd minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Richardson motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Members, today is perhaps one of the more exciting days in the committee because we get in your folders this year's version of Financing Education in Minnesota. This and the state aids booklet that HRD puts out. Mr. Strom, help me with that. I don't have it quite right.
Mr. Chair, members, you'll find two guidebooks in your folder, the purple one and the gray one. They both take a slightly different approach to school finance. So you can keep those in your folders all session long. Ms. Adrians and I will be working from those today, and throughout the year we'll reference those documents for you when certain bills are heard in the committee. Additionally, there's another document Ms. Burt is holding called Major State Aids and Taxes. And that document is one that our office puts together every couple of years. It's got time series information by county, by where the aids go, but through for all elements of government, and also where the revenue comes from. It's available online if people want to look at the version online, but there are also paper copies, and I know you as the chair have referred to that document several times in the past.
The Major State Aids and Credits is great reading, and I'm glad all of these documents, Mr. Strom, are available online to the public. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Wonderful. So, I was a teacher for 17 years. Assigning homework is kind of second nature. I won't assign, but I would encourage members to take some time with these three documents that have been referred to. With that, today is presentations from our nonpartisan staff, overview that should be helpful for good review for those of us who've been here before, and a good base building for our new members, and then we'll reserve the last part of the committee time to presentations from different education organizations that have a lobbying presence here at the legislature. Reminder, those presentations are limited to 2 minutes each. I see some people who represent multiple organizations are also asking for separate two-minute periods. Mr. Aronson, I don't know why you're blushing, but and that's just fine as well. Ms. Burt will be assisting with time management at that point. If you wish to testify before the committee to introduce yourself and your organization, we'll be doing this again tomorrow. Please let Ms. Burt know. With that, Mr. Strom, are you batting first?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Adrians is going first, and just one other note that if members have questions, it's just fine to ask them as we're going through the presentation. That might be most helpful for the committee members.
Very good. Ms. Adrians, welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And please rush us if we're going too slow, or tell us to slow down if we're going too fast. We might do both. Members, what we're going to start with, it's just this one-page sheet. At the very top, it says Education State Aid. And before we dive into the numbers, I want to make just a couple of points about some of these documents and documents you'll see throughout session. I know some of you are brand new to this, and some of you, it's nice just to have the reminders. In most cases, when you see dollar amounts listed, whether it's in a spreadsheet or other document, please remember that they will be shown in thousands. We will try to point out if it's not a number that's in thousands, but it's an important point just because there's a big difference between $9 million and $9 billion. So on this first sheet, what this is just a one-page high-level overview of the more detailed information that you will find in the spreadsheet. What this shows is state funding for the education budget area for just one fiscal year, for 2019. For our state budgeting purposes, the fiscal year, it goes from July 1st, and in this case, 2018, to June 30th of the following year. And this, so what it shows is just 1 year of funding. In the program area, under E-12 education, you'll see 9 categories. So these are the program areas for which nearly all of the state aid for education funding will be directed. When we talk about state aid in this context, I just want to point out also that it's in reference to money that's coming from the general fund. The general fund, it's the largest fund in the state treasury, and it's the fund into which receipts from most major taxes are deposited. So taxes like the individual and corporate income tax, sales tax, cigarette tax, and the like. Most of the money in the general fund is not earmarked for specific purposes. The general fund is the major source of funding for education, healthcare, and human services, and other major functions of government. So I just wanted to kind of make sure everybody has a quick understanding of the general fund. There's also funding that comes from other sources for education, like federal funds, fees, levy revenue, and we will touch on some of that later on in the presentation. So back to these 9 program areas. Across these programs, you can see that the vast majority of the money is funded through the first line, the general education line, at almost $7.3 billion. This is about 76% of the annual funding for the area. And then if you add in special education funding, that makes up almost 92% of state aid for education. The general education funding, so that first line, it's mostly made up of the basic formula allowance revenue for school districts, and that's the number that we'll talk about per adjusted pupil unit. So the amount is $6,312 per adjusted pupil unit for all districts. There are also additional general education components that are wrapped up in this funding line. There are things like referendum revenue, compensatory, operating capital revenue, and we'll also talk more about those when we walk through a district printout that shows revenue by school district. So the 9 program areas add up to just over $9.5 billion. Again, it's $9.5 billion, not $9.5 million. And in addition to that, funding is also appropriated to 4 state agencies that administer education across the state. That is just over $58 million. And this is, again, it's just for fiscal year 2019 for this sheet. So 1 year of funding amounts to just over $9.6 billion. I just want to point out that this is the largest budget area for the state general fund. And one other thing I want to point out is that we sometimes talk about funding in terms of biennial totals. And when we mention biennial totals, that's just the sum of 2 fiscal years. So just for reference, in this case, the 2 fiscal years would be 2018 and 2019 would make up the biennial total. And that is $18.8 billion on the bottom. So now I want to move from this one-page high-level overview to the spreadsheet. And that's the document that looks like this. It's on legal-sized paper, and it's always a lot of numbers. Please don't feel intimidated by it. It's just a lot of information that we try to put out.
Ms. Adrians, before we transition, Representative Jergen.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Adrians, you said a couple of times that the education funding is the greatest percentage from the general fund spending, and I saw some data from a few years ago that was about 42%. Has that changed? Are we still in that ballpark? Has it increased or decreased since that time? I think that was probably two or maybe even four-year-old data.
Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's exactly right. It's about 41-42%. And I think that stays pretty consistent for most years. If you ever see something where it shows all funds, then Health and Human Services usually eclipses education funding. But when we're talking about just state general aid, you're exactly right. It's about 40%.
Representative Jergens.
One follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. And then you also mentioned federal funds, fees, and levy. Do we have any data that shows if you were to take the general fund spending, add in the federal dollars, add in the fees, and then levies across all districts across the state, that $9.5 billion per year, what would that look like if you were to add that on top of it?
Ms. Adrians, Mr. Strom?
Go ahead. Well, Mr. Chair and members, we do have that information. That's a great question. And do you want to show it right now?
Sure.
Okay.
If that's a question you were going to get to later, I'll just wait. That's fine.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan.
Members, you're reading our minds, so we will get to that point further on in the presentation.
Ms. Adrians, can you make one distinction for the committee? You referred to the all funds. Can you just briefly walk members through what that means versus the state budget that we often talk about?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, I won't remember every single fund, but primarily when we're talking about the appropriations that each committee has jurisdiction over, it's the general fund. And when we're looking at all funds, that will include anything from federal revenues, but also we have special revenue funds. Anything that's fee-based will go into a special revenue fund. And the idea there is that it's self-sustaining. So you take in the amount of fee revenue that you need to run a program. There are several other that I'm sure I'm not remembering.
Mr. Chair, some members on your committee may serve on the Transportation Committee, mm-hmm. and that's an example where nearly all the funding is in a special revenue fund. Even though it's raised from much of it from state resources, it goes into a special revenue fund, so it's outside of the general fund.
Mr. Strom, is the Board of School Administrators a special revenue fund? Because I believe that entity is fully supported by the fees that administrators pay. Should I stop asking questions now?
No, Mr. Chair, we welcome all and any questions. The BOSA is on the spreadsheet, so I'll point it out to you. And it is general fund. That one actually is a special case because it has been general fund funded, but it will be special revenue funded. So we'll get to that as we go through it, if you don't mind.
Spoiler alert. All right. Thank you, Ms.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and members, if you will look at the spreadsheet, what I like to do is try to start with kind of a quick primer, sort of how to read the spreadsheet and just to point out a couple of things. I don't expect anyone to know all the numbers or be real professionals that are reading this. I just like to make it as easy as possible so that we can all get used to looking at the detail of the funding that the committee will consider in the upcoming months throughout session. So this each budget committee has a tracking sheet like this. They don't all look the same, which I know can be frustrating, but they all have very similar elements. And so this is the tracking that we will use for the E12 spending. And it will show general fund aid. And if we do make changes or have any special revenue accounts, I will add those later on in session to the bottom so that we can see all of the areas that the committee has jurisdiction over. So at the very top left hand, and I apologize for the small font. I have to use small font to get it all onto one page. But this is where you will find information that tells you if it's general fund, the aid appropriation summary, and then the numbers in this tracking are based on the 2018 November forecast. Now we'll have another forecast, the February forecast in 2019. Well, when that occurs, I will change numbers, and then you'll see the headings instead of November forecast, it will say February forecast. And again, there's another line that reminds you that all numbers are in thousands. Just to give you some information about what the forecast is and what that means, each year in November and in February, We think of it that way because we start with November. But Minnesota Management and Budget is required to project state revenues and expenditures based on current law. So the predictions that they make, that's what we call the forecast, and that is when the governor and the legislature base their budget proposals, they use the numbers from the forecast. And so within the forecast process, the Department of Revenue is required to forecast revenues to be received by school districts, counties, and towns. And I will talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And again, with the numbers being in thousands, most of these documents should say when the numbers are in thousands, just to keep hitting that home. So on this tracking, if you look at the columns, I label them A through S, just to give you a sense of, you know, if I needed to quickly point out a column, I like using the letters because I think that makes it a little bit easier to help orient within the spreadsheet. Each column is going to have an annual or biennial appropriation level, or it will show differences, so comparisons between multiple columns. So if you look at column J, for example, this is the difference between the November forecast, and EOS stands for end of session. So at the end of session, we have numbers that we sort of freeze in time, and then they're updated. A lot of them are updated for the November forecast. So this column will show you the difference between the November forecast numbers and the end of session numbers for the biennial total for 18 and 19. We eventually will get governor's budget recommendations. We will have House and Senate recommendations. And so the spreadsheet will consistently be updated to reflect when we have new information for numbers. And eventually the conference committee funding agreements that will also be put on here. So the rows to the left, I like to put numbers on each row. So again, if we needed to quickly look at just one line on the spreadsheet, that would be a quick way to direct you to a page on the spreadsheet. But this is where you can find more detail on that one page sheet that we started with. That was really high level with the 9 program areas in the budget. And what the spreadsheet has is lots of detail within each of those program areas. So, and the agencies also sometimes have some detail when available. And then at the very bottom of the entire spreadsheet, so if you'll go to page 4, this is where you'll find total appropriations. So if you're kind of looking for the grand total. So on that first sheet, we talked about $9.6 billion being spent for fiscal year 19. And you can find that number on this tracking if you look at column H.
Ms. Adrian, the handout that the committee has 3 pages. So the direction to go to page 4 is confusing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 4 is blank. You're correct. Mr. Chair and members, if you'll go to page 3, I'm just making sure you're all paying attention.
Good. Sneaky. And while I have members in your packets are rulers with a highlighted stripe down the center that are really handy for reading spreadsheets and keeping track of what line you're on. So these may be handy as well. Thank you, Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and members, good point. Those are nice because the numbers are really small. I have, I think, 5 of them in my office. I love those rulers. So if you'll look at column H, and I believe the row number is 192, so this is that number, that $9.6 billion number. So the totals for each of the years and the bienniums are on that bottom line. And as I said, there's lots of detail within each of the programs. I also wanted to point out, so the fiscal years for 2018 and 19, we're in the middle of fiscal year 19, but those numbers, legislatures have determined amounts to appropriate. Now, what we will be working from moving forward is fiscal years 2020 and 21, and then also 2022 and 2023. Now, currently, all of these years make up the base budget. The base budget, it gives the legislature a starting point from which to work from, and in this budget year, you will all determine the amounts that will be appropriated for fiscal years 2020 and 2021. We don't appropriate for the years for 22 and 23. We call those the tails, but we do determine amounts just for planning for future legislative sessions. Now, that's a lot of information, and I just want to point out one more thing. On the bottom left-hand side of each page, there's a little bit of additional information listed right underneath the rows. And so what this tells you is if a program is underlined, this means that it's a shifted program. Our current age shift is, we call it a 90-10 split. So you'll hear that a lot when we talk about 90-10. And what that means is 90% of the entitlement of the program is administered in a fiscal year, and 10% of that entitlement will be administered in the following fiscal year. When we have, and that 90-10 split has changed, so it's been as low as 60-40, I believe. And I don't know that we've ever been at 100%. Mr. Strom can tell you much more about the history of the age shift. But so I wanted to point that out. And then if a program is shaded, it indicates that a program is forecasted. And what that means is when it means that funding levels are adjusted during a budget forecast based on changes that might occur in caseloads, enrollments, or average costs of the program. And then once we receive the governor's budget recommendations and we start to have House recommendations introduced, some of the programs will be in italics, and that means that there's a recommended change to that program or grant. And Mr. Chair and members, I believe that's everything. We didn't want to get into the meat of the programs or the numbers. We just kind of wanted to give you a sense of how to look at the spreadsheet, and hope that's a good starting point.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, we're going to move next to the levy category. As Representative Juergens was pointing out, there's aid, levy, federal funds. There's a whole variety of revenues that we're going to be looking at. And we've got a one-page form here showing the levies that this committee has jurisdiction over. And then we'll look, after we just briefly go through this one-page sheet, we'll look at the tracking sheet that Ms. Adrians keeps for levy as well. The levy years essentially are categorized by their payable year. That lags one from the fiscal year. So a Pay 18 levy, the Pay 18 refers to the year the taxpayers pay it, is used for fiscal year 19, which is the 18-19 school district, or school year, I'm so sorry. The school year we're in now is fiscal year 19. And you can see the top line on this sheet shows that there's $2.88 billion of levies, local property tax money, that goes to school districts. As you look down the list, this is like the appropriations sheet, the one-page sheet, trying to summarize very briefly for you. The $2.8 billion, about $1.1 of that is spread on a tax base called referendum market value, and we're going to talk about tax base in just a moment here. And the remainder, about $1.7 billion, is computed on adjusted net tax capacity and spread on net tax capacity. As you look down the sheet, you can see the relative size of each of these levy programs. In the center column, you can see whether it's a tax on referendum market value or on ANTC. The third to last column shows the number of districts that are exercising that levy authority. And the last columns show whether the second to last column shows whether it's equalized, that is, whether tax base is taken into account with a state aid that wraps around that levy. And then the very last column shows whether an election by the voters is necessary for that revenue. So you can see as you go down the spreadsheet, that top category in the general fund, the operating referendum that the voters approve, is about $643 million statewide. The board approved operating referendums about 55 million, and you can go on down the list. You can see that between those two amounts, all the school districts have a referendum authority, but some of the levy amounts for smaller programs, only a couple of districts may exercise that levy authority. School districts in Minnesota are subject to levy caps. That is, there are state limitations on how much the board can levy. Most of those formulas are set as a dollars per pupil amount, like the operating referendum, which is board approved, a taxpayer or board approved. The building lease levy is one where there's a dollar cap as well. But a couple that have that are not dollar cap but are based on cost include the OPEB levies, the other post-employment benefit levies, and a few of the others that are listed on the spreadsheet here. But most of the levy authority determined by the state and generally with some sort of per pupil amount as the maximum levy for the districts. You can see through the funds there that the general fund's about $1.7 billion, the community service fund about $81 million of levy. The debt service levy for school districts is the levy they use to repay building bonds. You can see there that there's about $918 million of annual payments necessary to repay building bonds that schools have issued for school facility work. And finally, the last category listed is the other post-employment benefits that are done through a trust, and with the district selling bonds. There's only a group of 82 districts that use that approach. There was a one-year window that districts could sell bonds for other post-employment benefits, and you can see the annual repayment for those bonds is about $91 million. So in summary, about $2.88 billion of school levies for Pay 18 split amongst two different tax bases. With that, Ms. Adrians will talk about how to read the levy spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The next document we'd like for you to look at the very top left, it's titled Education Finance Levies. And so along with the state aid spreadsheet, the committee will use this levy tracking to just monitor the levy amounts, and then if there are any changes in policy related to levy, this is where it will be displayed. And I forgot the handy letters on the top of the columns, but you can read it very similarly to how the general fund tracking is read. And then, as Mr. Strom was saying, if you look at the last page, I believe it's page 4 on this tracking, in the future, so if you look at fiscal year 20, fiscal year 21, which is page 20, these total school district levy amounts, they are projected to go above $3 billion. So in page 20, it's $3.2 billion. In Pay 21, it's almost $3.5 billion. And most of the increase that is expected, I believe, is in the referendum area. And a lot of these are based on some of the fall 2019 elections. And so there will be operating referendum. So there'll be an estimated like $80 million that will come from that. And then debt service levies could have an estimated $50 million more in those areas. So that's where some of the increases will show up for these.
And, Mr. Chair, members, just as with your state aid, you will get a target for state aid to spend in this committee. You'll also essentially be given a levy target. Both of those targets are over base. The levy target in the last 15 years has always been zero. The tax chairs can be kind of tough on you as a committee. But even with the target being base, you can see the very bottom line that school property taxes are expected to increase under base budget primarily because of the voter-approved elections. So a zero levy target doesn't mean there won't be any change in levy from one year to the next, but it means that actions that this committee take can't go above that base level.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, if there aren't any questions on that, we'd like to take a very quick detour into property tax base.
Mr. Strom, before we do that, Representative Edelson has a question.
Yes, please.
Hi, thank you so much. Do we have, and I might be missing a handout, but do we have a historical tracking of the levy amounts, looking at district by district, what they've levied, and a trend that we've seen?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Adelson, we're happy to do that for you. We don't have that in the packets today. There's a couple of ways to measure levy. We can always measure that in total dollars, in dollars per pupil, or in tax rate, and we'd be happy to show you how those tax rates differ. Even with all three of those measures, one thing that also comes into play is the issue of value. Essentially, even if one looks at rates, for example, and says, "Well, gee, a $300,000 home pays this in Minneapolis and would also pay this in Black Duck," an argument might be made that, "Gee, well, that's not the same because a house in Black Duck may not be $300,000." So there's all sorts of different ways that that the staff try to help when we put together levy information. But we're glad to put together some district by district information on that for you.
Representative Edelson.
I would actually, that would be great to have some tracking, because what I really want to get to here is how much are local communities actually taking on and levying because the state is not funding certain areas. So thank you so much.
Yeah.
Mr. Strom, continue.
Mr. Chair, hand the keyboard over to Ms. Adrians. Next, we'd like to talk a little about the two different property tax bases. Again, feels a little out of area for the K-12 committee, but because you have almost $3 billion total levy, that's about a third of all of the, not quite a third of all of the property tax levy in the state, and changes that the tax committee makes will affect you. So it's important to have a good sense of that tax base. As I mentioned, there's with these tax bases, it's helpful for you to have a sense of how we arrive at them. We start with a definition of something called market value, and then we're going to move from that market value to show you how we arrive at the two different tax bases. As I mentioned, there's about $9.99 billion of property tax in Pay 18, and you can see on this pie chart the various shares. The school share is about 28%, so just a little bit under the county share, but it's the second largest share of property taxes. When we talk about getting to tax base, we always start with market value. That's really the assessed value of all of the taxable property in the state. There are a variety of property types that aren't taxable, things like government buildings, churches, schools, for the most part. Universities are not taxable, and those are not in that definition. But market value essentially includes all of the taxable property. We start there, and then our first tax base that we arrive at is going to be referendum market value, and that's where we're going to exclude the ag lands and seasonal rec property from the tax base. A couple quick charts to get you there. The chart on the left here, the pie on the left, shows that the market value for the current taxable year is about $691 billion, and you can see the relative shares of each of the types of property. Residential homestead properties, just about half. Ag lands are about 20% of the property. Commercial industrial or the business property is about 14% of market value, and the cabin seasonal rec about 4%. The remainder then is apartments and other non-residential property. When we get to our referendum market value tax base, the one that the operating referendum is calculated and spread on, the two parts of the pie that are missing are the ag lands and the seasonal rec property. And there, after you take those two out, you're taking about $160 billion of base away, and you can see the relative shares then change as the pie on the right shows. That's the tax base referendum market value that the voter-approved operating referendum goes against. There's a couple other smaller levies, the local optional revenue being the largest, but there's about five levies in total that go against referendum market value. All the rest are going to be on tax capacity. This is just a listing of those levies that fall on the referendum market value and their various amounts. The majority of the taxes that and the programs that this committee deals with, the property taxes use the tax base called net tax capacity. Net tax capacity starts with that taxable market value, and then the legislature has established a series of what they call legal class rates that go against the property by type. So it takes the estimated market value, it applies the class rates. We've got a little table here on the next page showing the amount of that, and the result of that is going to be net tax capacity. You can see that the legislature, with its class rates, favors certain classes of properties. Homestead properties up to $500,000 in value are at 1%. The amount over $500,000 is at 1.25%. Ag lands are primarily at 0.5%. You can see that one side note here, the house, garage, and 1 acre are taxed as if they were a homestead property at the 1%, but the ag lands up to the break point are at 0.5%. Commercial industrial, on the other hand, gets a less favorable class rate. Again, these are class rates set by the legislature at 2%. So essentially the first $150,000 is at 1.5%, but all of the remaining commercial industrial value is assigned a class rate of 2%. So we take these class rates against each of the types of property, and the result is net tax capacity. And so what this chart shows, on the left side, this paired chart shows the market value, the taxable market value, and the proportion that each part of each class of property pays. And then on the right side, it shows the net tax capacity. So you can see with these class rates, the residential homestead property drops from 48% to 42% of the tax base. Not a huge swing, but a slight benefit to the homestead property. The seasonal rec property and the non-residential homestead are about the same, but you can see the tremendous differences for ag lands and commercial industrial property. Ag land drops from 20% to 15%, and the commercial industrial are just about doubles from 14% to 26% on net tax capacity. So the class rates have the effect of having different classes of property bear a different amount of the burden of the property tax. One other way to look at this, if we jump ahead three slides and then we'll come back here. Oops. Let's see. Oh, I thought I had one more slide that was going to show the taxes paid. The taxes paid compared to the net tax capacity are even a little more skewed because business property in Minnesota pays about $1 billion a year into the statewide property, business and seasonal rec property into the statewide property tax that comes in as a state resource for the general fund. But the result is the legislature's created a system of property tax. Some would argue that it's quite fair in its current approach. Others argue that those class rates should still be changed. I know Representative Marquardt and his committee will be dealing a lot with both the ag class rate and the commercial industrial class rate this coming year. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's just a very brief detour into the property tax base.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just thinking that what you mentioned is the slide that you thought you were thinking of, I think probably would be useful for the committee, because as I understand what you're saying, and if you can clarify my understanding,
yes.
Well, if I don't have it right on it, or Representative Marquardt can do it for me.
we'll pull that slide up in just a minute here.
But the idea, though, that it's commercial property taxes paid that goes to the state, and then that's part of the school budgeting.
Yeah.
And Mr. Strom.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, that money comes into the state general fund, but that's essentially a resource that's available to the state when it makes its general fund allocations. Yep.
Right.
So, Mr. Strom, it's not dedicated to education.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Pryor? Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, what's the history of these market value and net tax capacity ratios? How have they changed over time, and how quickly or slowly have they changed?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandell, in the good old days, we used to be like most states, and we had a system called assessed value and mill rates. And in the late 80s, the state decided that they would go with this different definition using these class rates. There were still class rates and variation in property under the old system as well. But in 1989, I believe it was, we went to something called adjusted gross tax capacity, luckily for only 1 year, as we transitioned to adjusted net tax capacity, which had these class rates in place. And at that time, the range in class rates from the home ranged from 1% to 4% for the business property. Now, another of other things were going on behind the scenes there. There was also the homestead credit and some other things. But really, there was a very wide spread between the 1% class rate and the top 4% class rate. In the early 90s, both the House and Senate were very concerned with the referendum levy. It was growing very fast at the time, and there was some thought given that districts, particularly those with large commercial industrial property taxes, the voters were able to leverage that tax base. So legislation was passed in the early 90s that created this, or mid-90s, created this referendum market value tax base, with the idea being that $100,000 of home value would pay the same as $100,000 of business value. And so it was both sort of designed to slow down the growth in operating referendum at the time and also as a way outside of equalization to try and make the likelihood of a successful election this relatively the same in high commercial industrial tax bases as in other districts. Whether that really worked or not isn't entirely clear to me, but we've had those we've had that referendum market value for about 20 years now. The class rates haven't changed much over the last 5 to 10 years. The last big change was in the late 90s, early 2000s. But we've basically been at that 2-to-1 ratio for business property to homes, and roughly speaking, a 0.5-to-1% ratio for the ag lands to homes for almost the last 20 years. There's been some little variation in there, and the whole world of ag taxes is an agricultural lands taxes. It's enough to make me run screaming from the room. Representative Marquardt's committee deals with that a lot, and there's some breakpoints there, and there's treatment of homestead property and some other things that are very important internally to that discussion. But for those overall class rates, that 0.5, 1, and 2 is a pretty standard ratio for the last 20 years.
Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, do other states use the same method of achieving these market value and tax rate capacities?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit out of my area of expertise here. Most states use an assessed value and millage system of some sort, but there can be class rates from within those or different categories of property that are taxed differently. Minnesota's property tax system, I think, is about the most differentiated of all in the nation.
Representative Sandel?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, we'd like to go now to a general education printout. We always like to give you that one's on the long paper and violates the rule we just told you always to be looking in thousands of dollars. When we do a district-by-district printout, we're almost always putting it on a per-pupil basis. This is for two reasons. The first of those is because we can get more columns on the printout if we're not showing something in millions of dollars. But the second is the pupil units we're dealing with are estimated out into the future and are the most likely to change of the school district data. So when we do a printout on amount per pupil, if the reported pupil units change over time, we're telling a little bit better of a story than if we show a total dollar amount and there happens to be a bigger change in pupils than we expect from year to year. The way the general ed printout is listed, you'll see these for almost all the kinds of district-by-district runs. We're happy to sort these however you like. Usually we'll have some summary data at the top classifying districts, either metro, non-metro, or in some slightly finer categories by region perhaps. And then we list the districts usually in district number order, which on its face seems pretty crazy, but what that does is it groups school districts generally by county. And so for most of you, for example, Hennepin County is the 27th county. So most of the Hennepin County school districts start with 270. The Ramsey County is the 62nd county. So the Ramsey County districts go from 621 to 625. So by grouping them by district number, it allows members to see within their counties all of the school districts with their office in that county. We're, of course, happy to sort those printouts however you'd like. If people prefer them alphabetical, we're happy to do that. We can group them metro, non-metro, whatever makes sense. But we tend to find that the members, once they get used to the idea of them being organized in county alphabetical order, it makes the neighboring districts appear and makes it easier to judge the amounts. Then when we go across the district-by-district printouts, as we go across the columns, we'll almost always start with a pupil unit. We'll get into pupil units a fair amount tomorrow when we talk about enrollment, but the pupil units essentially is the base measure that we're dividing the total dollar by for each of those columns. As Ms. Adrians pointed out when we went through the appropriations overview, general education's the vast majority of your money. It's in these 10 different categories that go across the page. And by looking up and down the page for each of these categories, you can see how much the your district or your neighboring districts or other districts are receiving in those different categories. The basic formula allowance is the one thing that's all the same for districts across the state. That's currently at $6,312 per pupil unit. And if you look up and down the printout, every district's exactly the same there. The next columns are all designed to vary. They're intentional legislative decisions. They include categories such as compensatory, English learner revenue. You can see them listed on the spreadsheet all across the top there, and you can see how your district may compare to others. And then when you get to the very right end of the printout, these will get added together into the total general education revenue amount. Now, a couple other things, and we'll spend more time on printouts later. We just wanted to give you a quick overview on how to read one today. One other thing to remember is when we're looking at a printout on a program like general education revenue, that's a combination of aid and levy. We call that a revenue printout. That won't necessarily match with your appropriation number, which is a 90-10 split of the aid entitlement. But it's generally easiest for us to look at revenue. That's the amount that's due the school districts for that year for that program. So, Mr. Chair, we'll talk about each of these categories in some detail there. One last thing to point out about this printout, the way the statutes work, the operating referendum is defined as part of general education revenue. So even though that's voter approved and sort of outside of the other than the caps that this committee sets on that amount, we include operating referendum whenever we're including a general education printout because the statutory definition has that program as part of general education revenue. So, Mr. Chair, that's a general ed printout. We don't need to spend much time on that today, but it gives you a sense of how a printout is organized, and you'll see them for most every program that this committee considers this year. Mr. Chair, members, the chair had asked and others have asked about how total revenue varies by district if we add all the revenue together from all sources, not just general education revenue, but special education revenue, federal funds. If we add all the revenue together, how does district by district information look there? And we've got a printout here that's entitled Total Revenue All Funds. This is from the MDE website. It's a data series that has been called School District Profiles Data for years and years. It's a comprehensive data web tool that shows us both revenue and if we'd like to see, we can also see expenditures by category for each district. And the only bad thing about this spreadsheet is that it's always a year and a half out of date or thereabouts, because the department needs to close the fiscal year before they can do the final run for the next year. So we're anxiously awaiting the fiscal year 18 data, but for right now, fiscal year 17 is the latest for which we have total revenue for all school districts and charter schools. This printout's sorted with the total column, starting with a per pupil amount, and then a total column in the second column. And we had a question at committee the other day about how total revenue compares across all districts. And you can look at the top of the list and see that there's a charter school, the Metro Deaf Charter School, that has very, very high special education costs, and that they're at about $65,000 of revenue per pupil. And you can look down the list. You can see there's a few of these special purpose charter schools at the top of the list that are the highest revenue districts in the state. And then those revenue amounts fall down into $20,000 pretty quickly on the first page. And as you scroll through the pages to the end, you'll see those districts at the very lowest end of revenue statewide. And you'll see that we get as low as $8,606 for a charter school that's out in the Woodbury area. So all these revenue sources taken together, added up, there's a wide, wide range. Generally speaking, those at the very top of the list are those that serve primarily or all special education students and have a very high level of revenue because of that. This one we've sorted in order for you from most to least. We're happy to sort that any other way as well. And then as you go across the page, in addition to the total revenue, the printout shows the state aid amounts. So you can see the portion coming from the state and the portion coming from the local property taxes. And then you can see the portion coming from federal funds. About 5.3% Minnesota, relatively low amount of the total school budget is from federal funds. There are a few charter schools and a few school district schools that get well more than 5% of their money from federal funds, but generally speaking, it's pretty tightly clustered around that 5.5% or so. Those federal funds are primarily in three areas: Title I funding, special education funding, and school lunch funding. And then finally, there's another category, because what good would a spreadsheet be without an unexplainable other? But school districts also receive fees for various purposes. Those fees go into the other category, and some of the inter-district transfers of funds that are done between districts without going through the Department of Education are also in the other category of revenue. So those amounts make up that other category, which is about 7.5% of total school revenue. So again, you can look and see how your district varies compared to others, and as I said, we're happy to resort this in any way that's helpful to folks.
Representative Juergens.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the question I asked earlier, this is, if we look at page one, from all sources, fees, federal, state, $14,736 per year per student.
Yep.
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, yes, that's correct. And the pupil count we're using here is something that we call average daily membership, and we'll get into this tomorrow. So it's the unweighted count of pupils. And then the part about being tuitioned, there's some kids, a very small number, but for the districts they move into, it makes a big difference on these printouts, that move not through open enrollment but through a tuition agreement to another district. And so they're included in that count. Two school boards may agree that one's going to run the high school and the other's going to run the elementary school. And instead of open enrolling the kids, they'll use a tuition agreement. So that average daily membership, that's really the full-time count, unweighted for the kids that are there throughout that school year. So if a child spends two-thirds of the year in one district and one-third in another, they'll count as two-thirds of a pupil in that district and one-third in the other. But it's a throughout-the-year count. It's an average daily membership count. Some states use a count on a particular day or a set of days, but Minnesota's is throughout the year. And the average daily membership essentially is a measure of enrollment. It doesn't adjust for kids who miss because of absences. That doesn't affect one's average daily membership as long as the student remains enrolled.
Representative Juergens?
And Mr. Strom, does this include then, I know you went through the columns in the spreadsheet, but does it include all of the local levies, so operating levies, building levies, everything else, is that all included in these numbers somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, yes. In that property tax number, which conveniently totals a nice round number of $3,000 for fiscal year 17, that would include all of those. So that would include the operating referendum, the building lease levy, all of those levies that were on that one-page sheet, all of those are rolled together, and that for fiscal year 17 totaled $3,000 per pupil.
Okay, thank you.
Representative,
one final question then. Does this in any way account for students at private schools? They are, from a funding standpoint, I would think that they do not, but there are some special ed students at private schools, and so maybe some of the federal dollars might be impacted there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, that's a very good question. With our student counting in Minnesota, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, we start with the resident pupil count, which is those children attending public school. So that excludes the homeschool children and the traditional non-public students. When a homeschool child or a non-public traditional non-public student enrolls in a school district for part of the day through a special ed program, it's often under the shared time category, and there is a separate count of pupils that are shared time, called shared time pupils, that show up on Ms. Adrian's spreadsheets, and that and the school finance guidebooks will explain that a little more as well. But basically, the public school will count those students for the amount of time that they're there under the shared time program. So there is in that average daily membership count, there can be a shared time amount in there as well.
Mr. Strom, if memory serves, state support for students attending private schools, school nurses, transportation, textbooks, all those categories, adds up, or averages out to about $1,000 a student a year. How's my memory?
Better than mine. Mr. Chair, better than mine. I don't recall. We'll put a list of those together. A couple of the big ones, there's the non-public pupil transportation aid paid to the district for the transportation mandate for non-public schools. As you mentioned, there's the non-public aid, which covers the counseling and guidance. There's some of the state aid for special education under circumstances can be used for non-public students. So sort of a question of what you're counting there. On the tax side, there are some tax deductions and credits which may be directed partially to non-public students. So we can make a list for you of that amount, but I'm sorry, I don't know how much that would turn out to be for people.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Juergens, any more?
No, that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee for Ms. Adrians or Mr. Strom before we transition? Thank you both.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. So we will now have two-minute presentations from organizations that will be coming before us throughout the year, for throughout the session. The way we'll do this is I'll call up the first couple of people, who's up, who's on base, or on deck. Thank you very much. The chair aspires to be a better baseball fan. And you will have 2 minutes. Ms. Burt, sitting to my right, has a 30-second sign for you, just to keep you tracking. And we begin with the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. And Mr. Spies, and on deck is Education Minnesota, Ms. Micheletti, and Ms. Burt. Mr. Spies, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dabney, members. My name is Paul Spies. I'm the Legislative Action Team Lead for the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. My colleague, Kimberly Colbert, wishes she could be here with us this morning, but she sends her good welcome. I am here, and you have a packet in your, it's a black packet with our logo on the front, with our materials. And in that folder, is an outline of the issue that Minnesota faces and has faced for decades. It's a severe shortage of teachers of color, American Indian teachers, that does not reflect the growing diversity of our student population, which is now about 34%. So we have in this folder for you not only an issue brief, but we also have an outline of our bill summary that Representative Kunesh Bodine and Representative Mariani are going to be carrying for us this session. And we're looking for your support when we come here for a hearing. We're trying to do three main things in this bill that differs from the past. In the past, the legislature has only funded small programs with small impact. We're trying to do systemic change with strategic investments to move the needle at least 1% in the state. So the three things we're trying to do, as you see with the round circles, attract and prepare more candidates, increase program completion of those candidates, and increase retention of those candidates. All these things are really important and needed in order to move the needle. We look forward to working with you. We look forward to hearing from you. If you're interested in meeting and signing on to the bill that will be soon introduced, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spies. Ms. Micheletti, Ms. Burr, on deck is the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Mr. Amoroso, if you want to come down. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jody Boer.
And I'm Kathy Micheletti.
We are lobbyists at Education Minnesota, the union of more than 80,000 educators in Minnesota schools and campuses. 2019 will be a crucial year for education, and we hope that everyone can start their conversations from places of agreement. For example, there is now a consensus that increasing our students' access to mental health care providers is vital to making our schools safer and increasing equity. While there are disagreements on the size of the problem and the investments necessary, we certainly can accept that the nexus exists. At Education Minnesota, we believe directly hiring more counselors, social workers, and other support staff is one solution. Expanding full-service community schools is another. On another subject, we all agree Minnesota has a shortage of qualified teachers, especially teachers of color, which you just heard about. Our state must find ways to entice more people with deep content knowledge and training to make education their career. Just as importantly, we must keep the teachers already in our classrooms with better working conditions and enough pay to sustain their families. The issues around recruitment, retention, and licensure are braided together.
Mr. Chair, as Jody said, these issues are related, and to that end, our members believe the new law for licensing teachers needs adjustments, but not a major overhaul. We are suggesting changes that will provide additional supports to teachers who enter the classroom with fewer academic qualifications. Finally, our state must do better for its education support professionals. Paras, custodians, hall monitors, and secretaries hold our schools together. The staffing crisis in these jobs is deeply felt. Living wages, affordable health care, professional development, and safe staffing levels are crucial to recruiting ESPs and keeping them on the job. The need for new resources and policy changes is urgent. There are difficult decisions and conversations ahead. The problems are real, they are not going away, and we look forward to working with you on behalf of our students, parents, and the more than 80,000 educators working today in our schools and campuses. Thank you.
Ms. Boer, Ms. Micheletti, thank you both very much. Mr. Amoroso, next up is the Minnesota Association of School Business Professionals. Mr. Pyon, if you want to come on down. Mr. Amoroso, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Amoroso. I have the honor of serving as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Our association, for our new members, represents the superintendents of schools in the state of Minnesota, as well as other district-level administrators. I want to thank the chair for these couple of minutes. Basically, we're going to be with you all session doing what we believe is in the best interest of all public school students in the state. As a statewide organization, what we advocate for is different things that we believe have a positive impact for every school district, all 870-plus thousand public school students. Our top priority this session will be the general education formula. You just heard from Mr. Strom how that truly is the engine. And we've got to put the gasoline in the engine in order to have our public schools function. And so we're going to be looking at a 3-3 on the formula this year, which you understand is a big ask. But more importantly, we're going to be looking at trying to tie future increases to minimally the rate of inflation, just to provide our school districts with the opportunity to better prepare, to better plan, and save a lot of trauma that a lot of school districts are already experiencing as they begin to build their budgets for the 2019-2020 school year without knowing what type of funding they're going to receive from the state. So that's a conversation we hopefully can have. We also know that our state has a surplus. We also know that part of that surplus is one-time money. And one of the things that we'll ask you to consider is as we're looking at how can we best use that one-time money in terms of education, we had a grant program last year for safety and security within our schools. $255 million was requested. The grant program was for $25 million. So I think you can see that those $25 million went out. We have over $225 million of grants that weren't able to be funded. I'm not saying we need that many dollars, but it'd be nice to at least have a conversation about funding some of those grants that are already in the hopper. With that, I look forward to working with all of you over the course of the session. And if I or any of my members can ever be of service, please feel free to contact us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So thank you. On deck is the Service Employees International Union Local 284, Mr. Stinson. Yes, on deck, Mr. Pine. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dan Pine. I serve as the Director of Finance and Operations for South Washington County Schools. And I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, known as MASBO, as the chair of its legislative committee. MASBO is an organization of over 600 Minnesota school business professionals. We are the ones creating and monitoring budgets. We're preparing financial statements. We're making sure the buildings are heated and cooled. We're transporting the students and making sure all the students are fed. We're the ones that read the rules. We're the ones that when you play a board game, we actually look at the rules. It was kind of fortunate for me to come to this meeting because all this talk about property taxes and revenues, I mean, that's a bean counter's dream to come up here and have you talk about property taxes. The most vital number for all our business management states is the general education formula, and majority of our revenue is derived by multiplying the number of students by the basic formula. This formula has not kept up with inflation, causing a gap of over $600 per pupil since 2003. So we're suggesting an increase of 3% each year, and then tie the formula increases to inflation annually. That allows us better chances to plan, and as you know, we love to plan. Any increases in special education funding are also crucial, as a special education cross-subsidy, the amount required from the general fund to cover unfunded services is over $670 million statewide. If the federal government promise of converting 40% of the costs were upheld, it would leave about $250 million for the state to cover. We're asking the state portion be funded. Along the same lines, we need a fair and equitable special education funding formula. The new formula has created inequities among school districts because Fed costs are now reimbursed at different levels, and growth limits were put in place. The formula should be revised to remove the growth limit and add separate funding for programs such as ADSES and for transportation. We should also explore a system of cost sharing, the cost of transporting SPED open enrolled students.
Mr. Pine, can you complete your testimony, please?
Yes. Finally, we'd like to see the use of long-term facility maintenance revenue expanded to allow for construction of pre-kindergarten spaces, school physical safety and security improvements, and code compliance and energy improvements. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, sir. On deck after Mr. Stinson is Schools for Equity in Education. Mr. Lundell, if you want to come on down. Mr. Stinson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Stinson. I'm the Policy Director for SEIU Local 284. We represent more than 9,000 school service employees, including clerical staff, paraeducators, nutritional service workers, buildings and ground workers, early learning staff, custodians, bus drivers, and higher ed faculty throughout the state of Minnesota. Our local is working for a future where students in every Minnesota school have all that they need to succeed from pre-K to career. And our top priorities for this session are special education funding, an increase to the funding formula, and unemployment insurance for school employees. We know that districts struggle to keep up with the mandated costs of special education. We also know that appropriately supporting students with special needs is critical for their development and future success. Minnesota and the federal government don't pay their fair share of the costs of special education, which leaves local school districts to make up the difference. Everyone is asked to do more with less, and that's just not sustainable for any school employees, especially not special education paras. We are at the point now where staffing levels in too many Minnesota schools are unsafe for our members and for the students that they support. The inequity between property tax rich and property tax poor districts has been increasing for more than a decade. We need to return to an equitable funding formula so students in low property tax wealth communities have the same educational opportunities as students in affluent zip codes. Finally, many school district employees are exempted by state law from Minnesota's unemployment system. It's blatantly unfair that school district employees are excluded while resort, golf course, amusement park employees, and private subcontractors doing the same work in the schools are eligible. Our members deserve the same financial security that folks in other professions have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stinson. After Mr. Lundell is Mr. Lundell. All right. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Cloning is illegal in this. I'm Brad Lundell. I work with Schools for Equity Education. I'll also be talking for the Minnesota Association for Special Education as well, administrators. And I'll go very, very fast. Schools for Equity Education, we've kind of scaled things down this year. We're going to be talking a lot about the equalization that's been talked about with Mr. Strom and Mr. Stinson, just talked about the low property wealth, the challenges of low property wealth districts. Much of that discussion will probably take place in the Tax Committee, and it's good to see the Tax Chair is on the Education Funding Division, because I think that there's an interplay between what happens there and what happens here that really needs to be discussed and woven together. As far as adequacy goes, I think that we're also, like many here, looking at the general ed formula, but also looking at special education. And I think if you look at the Star Tribune article that was on Sunday, a lot of us are talking about special education and the growing cross-subsidy. And you can only spend a dollar once, and it'll be interesting to see. We want to be kind of discussing on both those angles, special education funding and general education funding, and where the twain shall meet there. As far as special education goes, I think that we talk, a lot of the discussion there will go in the Representative Joachim's policy division when we're talking about paperwork, talking about some of the streamlining that needs to take place. But I think we, as Mr. Pyne talked about, the formula that was implemented in 2013 has never been really funded in a way, way that's sufficient, so we've got these caps and lesser of kinds of things that are happening. They're causing districts a lot of problems when it comes to predictability and then, of course, adequacy as well. I also do some work with the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation, and again with Mr. Pyan and special education administrators. The open enrollment transportation as it relates to special education, there's a discrepancy there between regular open enrollment and special education open enrollment. We certainly want to have that taken looked at. And also the transportation portion of the special ed formula has been rolled in, and we believe that that should be rolled out. And finally, I do work with the school social workers and the school psychologists. We're supportive of the grant program that Representative Adelson has in her House File 2, and look forward to working with the committee here as that goes forward. Again, a lot of what you'll be seeing a lot of me this session on a lot of different issues. I look forward to working with every one of you on all of those issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Mr. Aronson, you're here twice as well, cloned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary School Principals Association and the Secondary School Association. And a few of the issues that we're interested in talking with you about, you know, for those of you who have been on the committee for a while, it's good to see you again. And for the members that are new, let me say the Elementary and Secondary Principals Associations have about 2,100 members. of the principals and assistant principals throughout the public schools in Minnesota. When you put that in the context of some of the other numbers, it's a pretty small, select, important group. And what we share with this committee is your charge for the maintenance of funding of the schools in Minnesota, which we think is probably one of the most important charges that the legislature has. On the secondary school principals legislative agenda, one of the issues that we'd like you to look very closely at this year is college in the schools. When you had the students here last week and they talked about PSEO and kids leaving the schools to go to the post-secondary institutions because they get free credits there, we do a really good job of college in the schools with our own teachers. The students don't have to leave, and they get those same college credits. And those of you that have been here for a while, when we went through the accreditation issues a couple years ago and you saw the quality of some of the teachers that are involved in that program, you can see the worth of it. We've funded $150 per person on the program there, but that appropriation is capped, and Mr. Chair, as you know, so it's as it's prorated out there, we don't get nearly that amount of money, and we have to pay the colleges for the classes. So we think at the secondary school principal level, that's a really good investment for this committee to look at. It does two things. One is it strengthens your small rural schools to keep the kids there, and we would like the kids with a live teacher in the classroom, avoiding the online learning program or having them physically leave the school when that happens. And in your large schools, it creates a lot of credit opportunities for kids in addition to AP and IB courses. So we'd like you to look really closely, and I know some members will have some bills on that, and we'll circulate looking for authors on that as well. On the elementary level, and this is on in both of our legislative platforms, and by the way, you'll get them in the mail, and they'll have our members' names on them, and look at that and see if some of the folks from your districts are on some of these committees, and get to know them, and we've asked them to get to know you. But take a look at those websites. But the elementary folks and the secondary folks are both interested in quality teachers. What can we do to attract quality people into the profession? It is always a challenge for us. A big part of that challenge is how much money do we have to pay them? One of the great things about being part of the education lobbying group is I can sit down here and I don't have to say three and three because I've already got 10 people that are going to come in and say that. We're happy to spend all the money and then some. What we promise you with our good faith is that we will do very good things with it. You can count on us for that, and that's top to bottom from the school boards to the SOOPs, to the administrators, to the principals, and to our teachers, who we value very much. So we look forward to working with you on that. I'd have to say, I know we're the finance committee, but we say this with the school principals very often. Anybody who gets to work in a public school in Minnesota is lucky. It's a great place to be. You guys play a major role in seeing that it is that great place to be, and that's what we're looking forward to continuing. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. On deck after Mr. Crossan is Mr. Monserrante from the Mini Minds Coalition. Mr. Crossan, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with the education advocacy group called Ed Allies, where we work on behalf of Minnesota's most underserved students, including students of color, students with disabilities, and our low-income learners. Now, many of you know that Minnesota faces some of the worst academic shortfalls for our communities of color and indigenous students in the country. Really, with only one in three of our students of color and indigenous students reading or doing math at grade level, low high school graduation rates, which is a result, which could be a direct result of our teacher diversity numbers as well. But we at Ed Allies think we can solve these gaps that persist in Minnesota by ensuring our students have equitable access to resources, by ensuring our students have teachers and school leaders who are highly effective and well-resourced, and ensuring our students have the ability to attend rigorous and engaging schools, both academically and culturally. And I'll have a moment to chat about some of these priorities in the future, but I want to just really highlight three policy priorities that we have coming up for this next upcoming session. The first is student-centered data, having student-centered data available and protected and disaggregated. We passed a law a couple of years ago to disaggregate student data, with a better understanding of race and ethnicity and cross-tabulating that data with special education services, with foster care status, et cetera. So we just want to make sure that those laws are protected and well-funded and resourced. And as part of the data is making it accessible to parents. Right now, I will just say frankly that our school report card, Minnesota report card, is very confusing. I encourage all of you to just take a second to look at our school report card and see how it can be improved. And we would look for an investment to the Department of Education to improve that school report card. Secondly, school dismissals. While 15% of our students are students with disabilities, 50% of our students with disability, or of all suspensions and expulsions, are students with disabilities. So investing in restorative justice practices and PBIS to decrease suspensions and expulsions statewide would be a priority. And lastly, we're part of the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Teachers Coalition, and as part of that, a huge chunk of our teachers of color are Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers. Advancing our Tier 1 and 2 teachers, protecting them and getting them to a Tier 3 and Tier 4 status would undoubtedly increase our teacher diversity numbers, as well as other factions in the teacher diversity bill that we support as well.
Thank you, Mr. Crossan. On deck, is there anyone here from the Minnesota State Academies? Anyone here from the Literacy Action Network? Anyone here from the Minnesota Business Partnership? Mr. Bartholomew, if you want to come down as being on deck. Mr. Heller, you'll be batting cleanup today. Mr. Monserrate, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Chair Dabney and members of the committee, my name is Alberto Monserrate. I'm campaign manager for the Mini Minds Coalition. We're a broad coalition of over 100 organizations and leaders from across the state, with a common commitment to prioritizing Minnesota's youngest in need as the most important investment that our state can make. Supporters vary in interest, size, geographic reach, representing the education community, philanthropic organizations, business, and nonprofits. We're committed to equitable access to high quality, accessible, and culturally competent early childhood care and education. You can see our priorities for this session in this document, and our membership is listed in the back. As you know, 90% of brain development happens before the age of 5, which is one of the many reasons early childhood is so important for the future of the state. We want to thank Chair Dabney and the members of the committee for your past leadership on early childhood and look forward to working with you to increase access and quality to early childhood. Thank you.
Mr. Monserrate. Mr. Bartholomew and Mr. Heller, you're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. The partnership's members are the leaders of Minnesota's larger employers, employers like Cargill, Ecolab, the Mayo Clinic, and Hormel. And together they employ about 400,000 Minnesotans and 2 million people worldwide. To help ensure Minnesota continues to successfully compete in a global economy and to maintain our state's quality of life, our members are committed to ensuring that every student has the best education possible. As a result, in addition to contributions and employee volunteers, our members have worked to provide opportunities for students and educators through PSEO, charter schools, and district self-governed schools, to pilot, evaluate, and expand parent-aware ratings and early learning scholarships. And we also recognize high-performing, highly diverse schools and share lessons learned. As our members work to improve student outcomes, we use 4 guiding principles. These principles are highlighted on the handout you've received, along with our recommendations for this session. The recommendations that specifically involve funding are under Principle 1, creating an open resource for teachers of sample lesson plans that are aligned with Minnesota's standards. Part of this is driven by data from the Department of Education that only 17% of our schools have implemented our English language arts standards. The second is under Principle 3, continue funding for the Minnesota Principals Academy. And finally, Principle 4, expanding access to parent aware and early learning scholarships. Thank you, and we look forward to working with you this session.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Heller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, everybody. At the Education Finance Committee, my name is Rick Hill, and I officially represent the twice exceptional and people with print disabilities to make sure that the records is unofficial, also that I have handouts. The handouts you have for today, I'm going to be speaking on briefly. It's a document for the, since the public doesn't have it. If you put this number into the search engine at the State Department of Education, you'll find it, MDE072397. That was created this year. It says, how long can students receive intervention prior to comprehensive evaluation? One of the key things that are in that score block, you'll see the reason, the, one of the most reasons the State Department's saying, reason kids aren't getting free of public education is based on their failure to follow their own procedures and make decisions to change interventions to evaluations. That's page 1 of 6. You turn the page over, in 2015, the legislature passed a law to have the State Department set the text complexity or the Lexile level. They have under the first paragraph online a reading disability, but if you listen to the recordings, it was the teachers, lobbyists that were saying they didn't understand the special education forms. I would ask that there be check boxes on the IEPs that would say that it's a standard-based IEP. Special Education Advisory Committee is currently considering to get a waiver on the 1% cap for people with cognitive disabilities. The next page you'll find is another document found on the State Department, 02218, you'll find it, Navigating the School System when a Child is Struggling with Reading Disability. You got page 21, it talks about Section 504 protects kids that have 504 plans. Those are kids that don't meet eligibility for special design instruction. On page 26 and 7, talks about expresses print disability and additional protections. I believe a checkbox should be on the special education forms because there's only two types of handicapped people found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, blind and print disability. And since the state longitudinal data system does not track that, we need to track that to find out the outcomes for those kids in the K-12 system. Last but least, the pink sheet. Last year, that was from Mr. Melcher, the State Department. There's currently no code for twice exceptional regarding Minnesota Statute 120B15, where you find that language, because there's no definition in the UFAR system, does not allow that program to be tracked for the twice exceptional. Those are kids that not only they were found gifted, but they also have a disc on their ability. Last but least, the people that I mostly likely represent on the last page on socialsecurity.gov. It talks about learning disability, dyslexia, English as a second language. It highlights and reads the words out loud as they're spoken. It does not mention blind and visually impaired. I appreciate anybody that wants to approach me on this audience, and thank you for this opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Any questions, any comments from the members? Seeing none. See you back here tomorrow. We stand adjourned.